Well, you may not know this and probably haven't ever imagined or guessed this, but I love amusement parks. I've always enjoyed rides, going fast and high with a little bit of danger mixed in. That makes it all the more exciting. Always enjoyed those kinds of things. However, it was a few years ago that I went with my kids to Canobie Lake Amusement Park that you're familiar with, just down the road in Salem. And at the time, my oldest son was, I'm guessing, 11, 12, something like that. And he wanted to ride this one particular ride right when you walked into the park. It's not there anymore. It was called the Equinox. And I looked at that ride and I thought, that ride is a little bit different than anything I've ever been on. It was an arm and it had a rotating thing at the end of it with three arms that went out. And so you sat down and they put this shoulder harness on you. And once you sat down in the shoulder harness, you're lined up with four or five different people next to you and you start spinning this way. And then the arm comes up and so you're still spinning this way. And then each one of those arms rotated as well, where you're going like head over heels this way. And then it had another hitch in it where the arm itself started rotating like this. And I've been on a number of rides, and that one really did me in. I had no idea what to anticipate, which way I was going to turn next, what way I was going to go. Usually, you know, you're on a ride, you're like, okay, I'll brace for the G-forces here. I kind of know. This thing, I had no idea. My head was going everywhere. And we get off that thing, and my son thought it was the greatest thing, and I thought, I never want to be on that thing again in my life. Well, I give you that story because I wonder if perhaps you haven't felt a bit like that as we've worked our way through the book of Ecclesiastes. Where from week to week, it's like, okay, I see where this is going, and the next week it's, boom, we're over here. And Solomon will give us this truth and say, life is like this, enjoy life. And in the next paragraph, he says, but life stinks because we can't know what's going to happen. And it's like we're jerked back and forth. We don't anticipate what's coming, and it can be dizzying. And in some ways, this is the nature of the genre that we're in called wisdom literature. And wisdom literature tends to be this way, where the author will like pick up a diamond and he'll look at it from this angle and he'll say, there's that. And then he'll twist it and he'll say, but look at it from this angle. And then he'll come back and say, well, let's look at this again and let's go a little deeper here. And so you feel like you're kind of off kilter as you go through this kind of literature and you're wondering, where is it going to land? And oftentimes it doesn't land. It gives you both realities and says both of these are true. Well, in our text this morning, we find yet another turn. And the reason I say that is because if you look at verse 11, when Solomon says, again, I saw under the sun, literally what he says there is, I turned and looked. So it's like he's looking this way and he's seeing things and he says, and I turned and I looked this way. And so he's throwing us in the other direction now. In Ecclesiastes 9 verses 7 through 10, Solomon has commanded us literally that we enjoy God-approved pleasures in this life. This is his gift to us. So enjoy life. You're eating and drinking and dress festively and enjoy companionship and enjoy the labor of your hands. And he tells us to do all of these things. And yet in our text today, he brings us back to the stark reality that the race isn't always to the fastest. Wisdom doesn't always prevail. Though you try hard to make life work your way, there are certain things that happen that you just can't predict. And life is difficult that way. And so it's like we're jerked back in the other direction. Solomon ultimately argues in our text today that from a human perspective, time and chance rule the outcome of one's life. And what he wants to teach us is that we shouldn't despair because this is true. We shouldn't give up all hope and cash it in, as it were. But rather, we should go ahead with life and live life with wisdom. Wisdom is the best choice in life. It's very apparent if you just look at the number of times that the word wisdom is used. We found it in verse 11, nor bread to the wise. We find it in verse 13. Here's an example of wisdom. We find it in verse 15, a poor wise man, but he by his wisdom delivered the city. Verse 16, wisdom is better than might. Verse 17, the words of the wise. Verse 18 begins with wisdom. So you can see he's talking a lot about wisdom here in the end. But he's going to set that up in the beginning with this notion that although wisdom is the better choice, wisdom doesn't always guarantee a good outcome. And that will become apparent in the text today. Nevertheless, he doesn't want us to go away from wisdom or not live a life of wisdom. In fact, what he teaches us is this, is that although human ability is no guarantee for success, living wisely is still the best option. And we'll see that in our text this morning, and I want to preach to you on this topic, winning with wisdom. I think that's what God communicates us through the words of Solomon here, winning with wisdom. Let's pray and help God to see how this is true. Lord, help us to see how your word is true for us and what you have explained to us about life that we know so well, that human ability doesn't always mean success. Yet in spite of that, in this broken world, we know that wisdom is best, to live according to your truth and the fear of God. And so help us to be people that are characterized by wisdom, not for our own sake, that we might manipulate the outcome of our lives, but that wisdom would be on display, and that indeed you would have the glory through people who live wisely. And we ask this in Jesus' name. Amen. Although human ability is no guarantee for success, living wisely is the best option in life. Notice how Solomon makes this point. In verses 11 and 12, he teaches us that human ability does not guarantee success in life. Our abilities don't automatically give us good things. They help us, but they don't guarantee that life will be successful. Look what he says in verse 11. Again, I turned, I saw that under the sun, that is on this earth, the race is not to the swift, nor the battle to the strong, nor bread to the wise, nor riches to the intelligent, nor favor with those with knowledge. But time and chance happen to them all. Solomon teaches us in verse 11 that the physically capable don't always win in life. He says the race is not to the swift, nor the battle to the strong. This is true in a very literal way. Last Friday was the opening ceremony for the 33rd Olympic Games that are being held the next 2 weeks in Paris, France. Athletes from all over the world have come together to compete in those events. For me, one of the most intriguing part of the Olympics is the fact that you have certain people coming to those events that have won gold medals before, they're well known. And the intriguing thing to me is when there's an upset. Somebody who's supposed to win, it's almost given their record and ability, they will win. And then you have somebody that's barely known and an upstart, and they take the medal. We know several stories like this. In Rio in 2016, you had two overwhelming favorites to win women's doubles in tennis, Venus and Serena Williams. They were well-known household names, international players, the top of their game. And yet they lost in the first round to two people who were hardly known. If I gave you their names, you wouldn't know them, from the Czech Republic. The race isn't always to the swift. In 2000 in Sydney, there was something called the Miracle on the Mat. This was Rulon Gardner, a United States wrestler in Greco-Roman wrestling, and he was up against Alexander Karelin from the USSR. Karelin was unbeaten for 13 years in international competition. It was just, this guy showed up and he walked away with all the trophies. That's just how it worked. And here's Rulon from somewhere in unknown Wyoming. Shows up, and because Karelin lost his grip at a particular time, Rulon took him to the mat and ultimately won the gold medal. Of course, you're probably all thinking, at least the older ones are thinking, of the Miracle on Ice, right? 1980, Lake Placid. Soviet team, professional hockey players, four-time defending gold champions, strong favorites. You had a bunch of ragtag amateur hockey players that showed up and for one game played the game of their life and beat the Russians. This is true practically, as I've just illustrated, that the race isn't always to the swift, the battle isn't always to the strong. What Solomon is saying is this: you would think life would work this way. The strongest always win, the fastest always win, those with the most ability. And what he's saying is, our human abilities don't always guarantee success. That's why they play the games. Well, maybe you say, well, I was never given over to physical ability. I'm not the kind of person that takes pride in my physical prowess or strength. I'm more of a person of the mind. I'm going to win with my wit. Well, the next statements are for you, because he says, nor does bread go to the wise. Bread is the idea of prosperity. That the wisest person doesn't always become the most prosperous person. There are many people who have been very, very poor financially, socially, and yet have been very, very wise. Wisdom does not always equate with prosperity. In addition, he says, nor riches to the intelligent. Your net worth, the money in your bank account, doesn't always reflect your IQ. Sometimes people come into wealth, and by the way that they live without wealth, they demonstrate that riches don't always go to the intelligent. Solomon is saying, you would think it always works out this way. Intelligent people are always rich people, or rich people must always be the intelligent ones. But he says, human ability doesn't always work this way. Physical capability don't always win. The mentally competent don't always succeed. This is what he's saying. Finally, he says, and nor favor to those with knowledge. Favor means favorable regard to those with knowledge, or those who can perceive a situation mentally. And again, he's just giving you illustration after illustration. He's saying this is how life works. Why? Why is it true that the physical capable don't always win and the mentally competent don't always succeed? That's verse 12. The end of verse 11, rather, into verse 12. He says, but time and chance happen to them all. Now that probably brings up some questions. You're thinking, we're talking about chance in the Bible? Doesn't that sound like God's not in control? Like this is fate? And the word chance, as it's translated here from the Hebrew, is a word that simply means an event. In 1 Kings chapter 5 and verse 4, it's translated as misfortune, which maybe isn't a lot better than chance. But basically what the word means is, from our human perspective under the sun, There are events that take place. Sometimes those events are to our advantage. Oftentimes they are to our disadvantage. And he's not saying that God has no control over those events. It's not that he's not providentially in control of those things. But he says, but looking at it from under the sun, from this side of eternity and life on earth, it's like time goes on and you're living your life according to time and boom, something blindsides you. Events happen, good or bad. And so, according to my physical ability and my mental acuity, I've got things worked out, and I think I'm working my plan, and this is how life is going to work out, and all of a sudden, boom, you're blindsided. And suddenly, it's not at all as you intended. And my physical capability and my mental competency got me nowhere, because look at where this has landed me. And this is what he's communicating, is that the future can suddenly change. The reason that your physical capability doesn't win you the race and the mentally competent don't always succeed is because your future can change suddenly. And that's what he means by time and chance happen to them all. And now he's going to illustrate that. Look at verse 12. For man does not know his time. We don't know what can happen in the future. And then he gives this illustration. It's like fish that are taken in an evil net, and like birds that are caught in a snare. So the children of man are snared in an evil time when it suddenly falls upon them. The idea here is suddenness. No one knows his time when suddenly these things will fall. It's like a fish taken in a net or birds in a snare. Now, if you're a fisherman or you're a hunter, you understand this. When you fish or when you hunt, it is primarily about deception. You want whatever you're fishing for or whatever you're hunting for to feel very, very safe. They know the future. It's okay to wander into that meadow. It's perfectly fine. That thing I'm hearing is exactly what I want, and I'm coming for it. That lure in the water looks just like that delicious little fish I ate last week. It's primarily about deception until suddenly, boom, you have your prey. And they're caught. What he's saying is life is like that. We get lured into these moments of, I've got everything under control. I can physically handle this. I've mentally got this figured out. Life's going exactly according to my plan. I'm very comfortable. And boom, it's like a trap. What he wants you to do is picture yourself not as the hunter, but as the prey. And the trap comes suddenly. It's that phone call that brings bad news that changes everything. It's that regular appointment in the doctor's office that you thought was just a yearly examination that suddenly changes everything. It's that conversation in a relationship that goes south and suddenly it changes everything. He says, so the children of men are snared in an evil time suddenly like this. This is just how life works. Sudden calamity removes these seeming advantages as strength and wisdom and intellect and knowledge. And so one writer has said that the things that human beings so often covet and seek to develop that are by no means bad things in themselves, fit bodies, strong, minds well educated and sharp, but these things do not bring control of the times. Things often happen to people that are unforeseen. They're beyond our control. And no one knows when any particular time will occur. Has that not been your experience in life? If not, you haven't lived long enough yet. Human ability does not guarantee success in life. So how should you live? You can respond and say, what's the use? I mean, to try to get ahead with my physical ability or mental capacity, if I can't control it and it might not work out to my best anyway, what's the use? You can despair and you can say, why run at all? Why work at all? Why play the game at all? The cards are stacked against me. And you can just check out and say, what's the use? Might as well not even try. Or you can swing to the other extreme and say, well, if it doesn't work out anyway, then I'm not going to live wisely, and I'm not going to use my capacity for anybody else but myself. And so I'm going to suck every kind of pleasure I can out of this life because that's all I have. And what you're faltering to is idolatry. And that's not going to be any better. What should you do? And this is where Solomon takes us now in verse 13. He says, here is the best way. And again, I've noted this at the beginning of the message, how often he uses the term wisdom in verses 13 to 18. He says, even though bread or prosperity is not always to the wise, yet living wisely is still the best option. And he's going to illustrate it, and he's going to state it plainly. And so secondly, what Solomon says is living wisely is the best option in life. But he begins with this little example that he's thinking of. And by this, he's going to teach us that wisdom is sometimes exercised and not rewarded. Look at what he says in verse 13. I have also seen this example of wisdom under the sun, and it seemed great to me. When he says it seemed great to me, what he's saying is, This example really struck me. It really kind of encapsulated what I'm trying to talk about here. This seemed to be the thing that really solidified this with me. So see if this does it for you. Verse 14, he says, there was a little city with few men in it, and a great king came against it and besieged it, building great siege works against it. But there was found in it a poor, wise man, and he, by his wisdom, delivered the city. Yet no one remembered that poor man. He uses these terms like little and few, contrasted with great, large. He's saying, if we're talking about human ability, it was all on one side, this great king, these large siege works, and they're coming against this little city with few people in it. But there was a guy in that city who was wise enough to deliver those people, and even though he did, people soon forgot about him. Now, what is Solomon thinking of here in particular? Here's an example of this kind of idea of wisdom under the sun. He probably does have a specific event in mind that Solomon's thinking about. We're not sure what event that might have been. It may have been something in the life of his own father David. Back in 1 Samuel chapter 23, David is on the run from Saul. He's in the wilderness, and Saul is trying to find him. And David gets word that there's a little town called Keilah. And this little city of Keilah is being assaulted by the Philistines, this much larger group of people. And so David inquires of the Lord if he should go and deliver the city, and God says yes. And so David goes with his band of men, and he, which I'm sure was a wise strategy, defeated the Philistines at Keilah and saved that city. And so he's welcomed into the city, and David's a part of the city. Well, word gets out to Saul, David's in Keilah. And Saul says, I've got him now. He has put himself in a city, and he can't escape. And so Saul comes, and he's getting ready to march on that city. And you know what? David is wondering, will these people protect me in this city? And he inquires of the Lord, and God says, David, those people are going to forget you. They're going to turn you over to Saul. You need to get out of there. It might be that Solomon has that in mind. Here was a man, a poor man, on the run from Saul. He delivered this city, and yet when it came for them to protect him, they didn't even think about it. It might be. But we do have an example of Scripture that very much parallels this. Solomon wouldn't have this in mind because it happened after his time. But let me show it to you. It's very interesting. Look at 2 Samuel 20. And here, it's not a wise man in the city, it's a wise woman. We don't even know her name. And when I read it to you, I know if you are prone to reading the Bible and you read through the Bible, you've read this story, but I guarantee you've probably forgotten it. I had, until I was reminded of it in another work this week, and I read it and I thought, that sounds very similar. 2 Samuel chapter 20. Let me set some context for you. We're going to be looking at verse 14. We're told about a guy named Sheba. Sheba rebelled against King David after the death of Absalom. Remember, David's king, his own son, becomes traitorous and turns against him. Absalom finally is killed, and David is coming to reestablish himself in Jerusalem. But there's this one guy, his name is Sheba, and he still doesn't like David, and he's a traitor. And he's trying to gather people to his side to turn against King David. And so Joab, David's general, knows that Sheba's a scoundrel and he has to be dealt with. So Joab seeks out Sheba. He's trying to do away with David's rival. And Sheba goes to a city called Abel. And there he hides himself in that city, thinking that they will defend him from Joab, and so that he won't be found out and ultimately executed. Well, Joab lays siege to the city. Look at verse 14. And Sheba passed through all the tribes of Israel to Abel of Bethmaachah, and all the Bichrites assembled and followed him in. And all the men who were with Joab came and besieged him in Abel Bethmaachah. They cast up a mound against the city and stood against the rampart, and they were battering the wall to throw it down. Then, verse 16, a wise woman called from the city, listen, tell Joab, come here that I may speak to you. And he came near her, and the woman said, are you Joab? He answered, I am. And she said to him, listen to the words of your servant. He answered, I'm listening. Then she said, they used to say in former times, let them but ask counsel at Abel, and so they settled a matter. I am one of those who are peaceful and faithful in Israel. You seek to destroy a city that is a mother in Israel. Why will you swallow up the heritage of the Lord? Joab answered, far be it from me that I should swallow up or destroy. That is not true. But a man of the hill country of Ephraim called Sheba, the son of Bichri, has lifted up his hand against King David. Give up him alone, and I will withdraw from the city. And the woman said to Joab, behold, his head shall be thrown to you over the wall. Then the woman went to all the people in her wisdom, and that's exactly what they did. Here's a wise woman. This city is thinking we are entrenched for battle against Joab. He's laying siege to the city. And what does she do? She doesn't shout and scream, but in her wisdom, she says, Joab, come here. Let's talk about this. She finds out what the problem is. She takes care of the problem. Joab leaves. We don't even know the woman's name. She's forgotten. But that wise woman delivered the city. So we'll go back to Ecclesiastes. This is exactly what Solomon is saying. This is wisdom. And he gives us this illustration. Here's how one wise person can actually overcome all the strength and might determined to go to war. Wisdom is better than weapons. Having the conversation, sitting down and speaking, wisdom is better. Wisdom is sometimes exercised but not rewarded. And so now in verses 16 to 18, he says, yet wisdom is still better. And by this, he brings us to conclusion. He says in verse 16, but I say, wisdom is better than might, though the poor man's wisdom is despised and his words are not heard. The words of the wise heard in quiet are better than the shouting of ruler among fools. Wisdom is better than weapons of war, but one sinner destroys much good. What's his point? In verse 16, when he says that wisdom is better than might or ability, he says, you have the situation of a city, and in that situation, the man's wisdom did deliver the city. We would say in our illustration, the woman's wisdom did deliver the city. It was better than the sword. It was better than might. So he's saying, this is an example of what wisdom can do. It can be better than the exercise of physical strength or mental acumen, even if it's not always appreciated, even if people forget about you. Wisdom is still valuable. People's lives were saved. He says in verse 17, wise words in quiet are better than shouting. The words of the wise heard in quiet are better than the shouting of a ruler among fools. He says, here's the value of wisdom. The point being here is that a wise man can make himself understood in a quiet, calm environment, but it's often a ruler that wants to enforce his agenda through loud shouting and shouting everybody down and shouting among fools, maybe getting them all stirred up about something. But a wise person can come into a quiet, peaceful environment and deal with it wisely and actually have a better outcome. Now, I'm not sure of anything that's more starkly illustrated than in our 21st century American culture in an election year. When you have people and candidates that stand behind podiums and make boastful, loud shouts among sometimes people that are very foolish and try to stir people up, and there's not an ounce of wisdom in what they say. And yet if they would just listen to maybe a quiet person that would come in and speak a word of wisdom, it would be so much better than the boastful might of a political candidate. Wisdom is gracious, it's quiet, it's peaceful. Oftentimes in homes, wisdom is not seen. There are times of shouting and arguing and accusing. And the Bible says, that's not wisdom. Wisdom is quiet. Wise words are oftentimes spoken softly. They're meant to be words of appeal. Look at what Proverbs says about this kind of speech with regarding wisdom. It says in Proverbs 15:1, a soft answer turns away wrath, but harsh words stir up anger. When we want something really, really bad, we raise our voice, we start making demands, and it says a soft answer is wise. It turns away that anger. It diffuses it. Proverbs 15 and verse 2 says this, the tongue of the wise commends knowledge. Wise words spoken appropriately, they're filled with knowledge, but the mouths of fools pour out folly. A fool just opens his mouth in a rant and lets it all out. Here's what I feel, and it's all in my head, and soon it's on your lap from my lips, right? It says the tongue of the wise commends knowledge. They think about what they say. They think about how it's coming across. Proverbs 16 and verse 24 says, gracious words are like a honeycomb, sweetness to the soul and the health of a body. Does that describe your words? When you speak to people, would they say, those are like honeycomb to me. They're sweet. I understand the wisdom in that and I take it in. They bring health to me. Are they cutting? Are they abusive? Are they discouraging? These are wise words, often spoken in quiet. Proverbs 29:11 says, a fool gives full vent to his spirit, but a wise man holds it back. A fool, again, just lets it all out. A wise man holds it in, knows what to say, when to say it, how to say it. I think Solomon is commending this. He's saying you have a poor wise man in a city. Like in our illustration, it's the woman in the city who said, let's just have a conversation about this. And let's make sure it's a good conversation. It's not filled with anger or turmoil or outbursts or rants. And Solomon is commending this in verse 17. The words of the wise heard in quiet are better than those things. That's living with wisdom. Finally, he makes this stark statement at the end of verse 18, or in verse 18, when he says, wisdom is better than weapons of war. You would think, if I'm going to war, I want the biggest, baddest nuke possible, right? He says, there's a better way. Wisdom is mightier. It's better for all involved. Wisdom is stronger than that. If it will be heeded, it's not always heeded. And so he's commending it. Don't go to war. Go for wisdom. When words are heeded, weapons of war can be overcome. One writer says, yet even then it only takes one sinner to nullify all the good that either was done or might have been done. And that's how he concludes, but one sinner destroys much good. Somebody who will not live wisely with words of wisdom, it's like they drop the bomb and blow everything up. And he's going to go on, he's going to talk about that in chapter 10. Solomon says, living wisely is the best option in life, even though it's not always heeded. Even though that man in the city was forgotten, he did deliver the city. Although human ability is no guarantee for success, living wisely is still best. It's the best option. I read an illustration of this very point. A man named Zach Eswine, he wrote a book entitled Recovering Eden, The Gospel According to Ecclesiastes. And I read his comments on this, and he gives an illustration that just for me really put into words and thought that what this passage is communicating to us. It's a bit of a lengthy illustration, but I think I'll read it in a way that will be engaging and will help you. Here's what Eswine says. He says, imagine a basketball team made up of 7 and 8-year-olds. One team cheats, trips, trash talks, and pushes. Imagine that the referees are friends of the cheating team's coaches. It becomes obvious that the referees are biased in favor of this cheating team. Now imagine that you are the coach of the opposing team. What do you tell your players? You can tell them, quit. You can say, I hate this game. There's no point in trying because no matter what you do, you will not win. And you can get hurt in the process. We're not playing anymore. Let's get out of here. Or you can tell them, you should return the same kind of behavior. You can say to your team, I hate this game, and since this is all unfair and no one seems to care, you do the same thing to them. You too need to cheat, trip, trash talk, and push. If the only way to get ahead is to break the rules, so be it. We'll break those rules. He goes on to say, the preacher, by that he means Solomon in Ecclesiastes, looks at both of those options regarding life. He fully understands what it means to hate how the game is being played. But when he looks at walking away, this leaves folly to win on the court. And folly then becomes the only game in town. Likewise, when he looks at joining in and fighting folly with folly, this too leaves only folly on the court. And folly still remains the only game in town. The preacher agrees on the one hand, I hate this life, he admits, but the response This kind of hatred promotes differs substantially from the other two. He says, I will oppose the life I hate with wisdom, he's seeming to say. Not because I will win in this world, I likely will not. But at least wisdom will remain on the court. At least folly will no longer offer the only game in town. At least those who watch the game will have an alternative set in front of them, and those who play and get hurt will have a way of healing still available to them. You see what he's saying? Because we live in verses 11 and 12, and it seems like no matter what we do, we don't get ahead, and the cards are stacked against us, and the game isn't played fair, we can say, I want to quit playing the game, or I'm not going to play fair, and all you do is you just promote folly and foolish living. And what Solomon is saying is this, wisdom is the best option, even if it doesn't ultimately get you ahead, because you're leaving an example for those 7- and 8-year-olds. You're showing something different. Something different about God and who He is and how I should live in a world that even seems stacked against me. Wisdom is the best option. We do not play this game of life to win for ourselves. We play it because of God and for His glory. And out of love for others to show them a better way. So knowing that you cannot guarantee the future with your human ability, and knowing that sudden calamity comes upon us all and doesn't seem fair, and knowing that wisdom exercised is not always remembered or rewarded, don't despair, my friend. Live wisely. Fear God. Keep His commandments. That's what He's called us to do. And wisdom will remain to be seen by all. Let's pray together.